Welcome to Pastures of Plenty, a history of California farm workers, hard times in the country. I'm Luis Valdez. In this program, we look at the Great Depression through first-person stories. It was one of the most tumultuous times in farm labor history, as epic battles raged up and down the state, and the huge agricultural industry teetered on the brink of collapse. In the mid-30s, Dust Bowl refugees flooded into California, competing with immigrants from Asia, the Philippines, and Europe for farm jobs. It was a recipe for racial tension, but also for labor organizing. Today's farm labor force is mostly from Mexico, but in the 1930s, it was a patchwork of people, many of them of European descent. What greeted them was some of the hardest kind of labor on earth.
We spent 31 in picking hops out of Sebastopol. I was probably wasn't even 11 years old then.
There were people living in shacks made out of orange crates. One family with a whole lot of kids were living in a piano box.
So we got a tent that was just a little cover over a bed. That was our house. But I remember sticking out our hands, you know, out of the covers into the rain, you know, to get our hands wet.
Dorothea Lange's pictured us as having great despair. I remember nothing but laughter and happiness. I had a wonderful childhood. We weren't ever hungry.
I remember nothing else to eat. My mother fixes gravy and biscuits, and I'd go out and get some tomatoes and squeeze them in this gravy and eat it. Tastes pretty good.
They gave me a bucket and a ladder and sent me into an apricot orchard. And there were braceros in the crew there with me. And I'm hotshot, you know, college bound, you know, math and science whiz in high school, jock. Man, they had me cold. Took about an hour and a half, and I knew that, man, this is not only hard, but skill. There's skill involved in that.
Many immigrants from Europe brought that skill with them to California in the 1920s. Skill and family connections allowed them to work their way into farm ownership much more quickly than Asian and Filipino immigrants who were banned from ownership by the alien land laws. Producer Rachel Ann Goodman begins this program by taking us to California's Central Coast to meet the son of an Italian irrigator who worked all his life to own a small ranch.
The Gulch Ranch, north of Santa Cruz, is 100 acres of wind and fog-bathed benchland overlooking the Pacific. In 1922, Gervasio and Valentina Camelli decided they would rather risk farming Brussels sprouts here in California than live another year under Mussolini in northern Italy. Their son, Ivano, shows me the place the Italians called La Nostra Costa, or Our Coast.
My name is Ivano Franco Camelli. I was born and raised in Santa Cruz County on the Coast Road, about 3 miles north of Santa Cruz, and I was lived with my family, and we're looking at the fields out here. They're bare today, but my father, who was an immigrant from Italy, in 1923, worked these ranches from 1923 until almost when he died in 1983. You can see, you can't see on the radio, but I am dressed as my father would be in his ranchari outfit, which was Levi's and an old brown shirt. And he used to wear a hat, used to wear that. And he used to have usually his tools with him. And his tool was la chavala, which is the shovel. And before the advent of the whirly bird sprinklers, which you see in all the farms today, it used to be they used to have to irrigate this entire ranch. They used to do it all by hand and shovel. And they filled this reservoir up with water. And the bagnatore, that's what they called them, irrigators, would be in the field with his shovela. And there would be a series of ditches, which they would have in the fields, which would be in between every 3 to 6 rows of sprouts. And as the water came down, they, through the ditches, they would run down to the end of the ditch, and then they would use their trusty shovela to break the ends of the ditch and allow the water to flow from side to side.
All right, I'm going to read from A Ranchero's Lament, which is in my book, La Nostra Costa, A Family's Journey to and from the North Coast of Santa Cruz, which covers the period 1923 to 1983. And pretty well in The Ranchero's Lament tells how it was in about 1937 during the those dark days of the Depression. On a particularly foggy morning, a ranchero was in the field, dutifully irrigating the crops. He was deeply depressed. Leaning on his shovela, he looked up into the obscured sky. With sadness in his voice and as though expecting something or someone to be up there, he began his lament. I work every day in this field. I am ankle deep in mud. All I smell is pattume, that's the Italian word for manure, and in a couple of hours il vento, the wind, will blow dirt and debris in my face. Next month the rains will come, they will soak me through, and I will have to carry those wet sprout sacks up and down these muddy roads. I work 10 to 12 hours every day for very little money. My young son is sick, and I cannot pay the doctor. My young wife is pregnant, and our second baby's on its way. Where will I get the money to feed another mouth? I promised my beautiful wife an easy life in America. All she got was hard work and desperate times. If there is a God up there, why doesn't he show himself? Why doesn't he make my son well? Why doesn't he help me? I need more money. Oh God, if you're up there, why don't you wave your hand and make things better for me? Not really expecting an answer, the ranchero lowered his head and with a shovel slowly returned to working the soil. Then from out of the thick, eerie mist, he thought he heard someone, perhaps a woman, say in a soft and gentle voice, "Oh, ranchero mi, don't you know? You live super la costa, not heaven."
So who's this?
This is Norma. Oh, get her here. She's coming down here. Norma was born on a ranch about 3 or 4 miles from here, which is the Lorenzi Ranch. And she grew up on the Lorenzi Ranch as a young girl, and she has many tales to tell about being a girl on the ranch.
Yeah, my dad was a bagnatore also, and he also disced with the horses, which before tractors.
Yeah. Way so before tractors. Tell me your full name again.
It's Norma Danelli Wilson.
Danelli was your maiden name.
Uh-huh.
And
the Italian part.
What was your dad's name?
Dante Danelli.
And he farmed just up the road?
Yeah, he farmed with the Grassis and then with on the Lorenzi Ranch. We all went to school, most of us, not knowing English at all. And we go to, you know, the first grade or kindergarten, not know a word of English. And then, of course, our lunches were different from the, you know.
What'd you have?
Well, we, you know, you kind of got, because you would open up your lunch and all the American kids would say, "What's that?" Because we had fried zucchini sandwiches or meatballs or...
They were taught that you stay here on the coast
and
don't go to Santa Cruz. Because that's different. Santa Cruz is American, and this is La Nostra Costa. This is our coast, the Italian coast.
If the Italians didn't mix with the American kids, neither did they mix with the other immigrant workers.
This is the backside of the ranch, and it used to be, in the old days, the Filipinos used to be here. Now, the Filipinos and the Italian ranch workers, which we call rancheri, worked together in the field and had no problem at all. But they never socialized or they never bunked together. It was always had separate quarters. The Filipinos would be down here in these houses here in the lower end, and they would have their own cookhouse, their own cook, and they would have their own events. They would have cockfights and what have you.
When World War II began, because they were Italians, the Camellis were declared enemy aliens, and they were banned from working near the coast.
The Italians were allied with the Nazis during that period, 1942. So they made laws against the Italians and, of course, the Japanese. And the white line here on Highway 1 was the dividing line. And you couldn't cross that white line and be on this side of the coast.
Because you'd flag down a ship or what?
Oh, yeah, flag down on a submarine because you're closer to the ocean here. So my dad, of course, you see, most of the ranch is on that side of the road. So he had to find another job. So he lost his job and had to go to Santa Cruz to get a job
on that side of the highway, on the north side of the highway, or actually the east side of the highway, to make it. So,
though the Depression and the war years were tough on the Camelli family, they always found ways to celebrate with other Italian farm families.
So anyway, there's this funny story I like to tell, because it was farmers, they would get a few drinks into them, and then they would try to have these contests on who could sing the highest and the lowest. And one of their favorite songs was singing Quel Mazzolin di Fiori, and they would try to hit the high notes and the low notes. Well, there was this one young fellow named Rino Rinaldi. He had a real high-pitched voice, so he would sing the high notes. And then we had this older feller, it was named Pete Brovia, and he had a real low voice, and he would hit the low voice. So they would start out like, Rino would start out, and he would go, Quel Mazzolin di Fiori. And then the group would join in, Che vien de la montagna. And bada ben che non si bagna, che lo voglio regalar. And then Pete Broy, way down low, lo voglio regalare. And they would have this contest. Reno up here and Pete Brovia down here. And see, and then they'd drink more wine, they'd drink.
It was got higher.
Yeah. And they'd be, of course, they'd be like me, off key. But the more off key they would be, the funnier it got. And that went on quite a bit during the day.
The Italians had brought their close-knit community with them, recreating it on California's central coast. Now, the grandson of the Camelli's neighbor, Billy Redoni, is continuing the Italian farming tradition.
Billy! How are you?
Hi, Phil. How are you?
Long time
to
see.
I know.
They're one of the few families that stuck it out all these years.
Yeah.
And are in farming. We were describing how it was good the old ways, and I thought maybe you'd describe some of the new ways. I noticed your sprout clean machine. Now, your grandfather was one of the first that built a sprout clean machine.
It was
a barrel type.
It's a roller system, and the sprouts roll over it, and the smaller stuff, the chopped up stuff, and the stems actually fall through it, and they fall into a coal line, and it just goes out into a truck. Yeah, if we had to do the seed beds like back in the old days, we wouldn't have got them done this year.
That's a question I always ask farmers is, you know, we have your up years and your down years. How can you stay in it so long? Has your family persisted so long through the good and the bad? They just ride out the bad years or what?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. You do. You got to ride out the bad years. Hopefully it's not doesn't go too deep.
Today, you can still buy artichokes and Brussels sprouts grown by the Rodonis, the Fambrinis, and the Donatellis. Evidence the Italian farming community on La Nostra Costa is still alive and well in California. Right after this short break, we'll meet a Croatian apple farmer whose orchards date back a whole century. This is Pastures of Plenty. Welcome back to Pastures of Plenty. I'm Rachel Ann Goodman. Just 20 miles south from Santa Cruz is a place writer Jack London once called New Dalmatia because so many Croatian apple farmers lived there. It's now known as the Pajaro Valley, a green, lush bottomland which produces 70% of the nation's strawberries. A few feet from the San Andreas Fault, surrounded by impossibly green, rolling hills, is Gizdic Ranch. It's a working apple and berry farm which dates back to the heyday of the Croatian immigration at the turn of the 20th century.
My name is Nita Gizdic. My maiden name is Korac, also Croatian. My father came from Croatia. My mother came to Sacramento with her family and lived in Sacramento. And someone told my father there was lovely girls in Sacramento at that time. So he went up there and met my mother, brought her back here. I was born around the corner, so I've been here in Wattsville all my life. I had an uncle that came first, and he was the one that brought my father and my two aunts. But he was here for 16 years, and in 16 years he was able to buy some ground and had his apple orchard and was picking and shipping. My father farmed the little piece of land down there, but he also worked in harvesting the apples and pruning and thinning apples during the year to make extra money. And it was wonderful.
Through family connections, new arrivals moved quickly from laborers to owners. The happiest memories of the old days involved food and dancing.
And then they would have barbecues on different farms here. The Caporizas used to have some beautiful barbecues out at their ranch, and my father played an instrument which was called the gusla, which was put on the lap and with just two or three little strings, and the women would dance, and you were dancing out of the dirt, right, in the yard in there. We have pictures of that when we were kids, and we loved it because as kids got to go run around. Out here we're walking on the 10 acres that my father-in-law originally bought right here, and the piece that we're walking on right here at the when he arrived was empty. This is where they planted their tomatoes right here. And then 5 acres of apples were over here on our right. So these apples here are, every 4 rows is a different variety for the pick yourself. And you'll notice the trees are semi-dwarf, so we don't have to use ladders.
Up on the ladder at 7:45, the apples are ripe and they're dropping. Just wait till the sun burns through this old mist, and then I can pick without stopping. My best faded jeans, they're home in a drawer. I'm dressed like a real working person, skimming off the red color with cold fumbling hands, flicking spurs, dodging branches and cursing.
And you climb your ladder and go up, and each cluster, now do you want to have some larger apples? You're going to take away maybe 4 of those apples and leave 1 so that it will be larger. Here we're going to be going through our thinning here late June, and we will harvest usually starting in mid, usually some varieties of Gramercy will start about mid-August and go right on through until the end of October with some of our varieties. And they're all hand-picked, you know, into a nice bag that's around your neck, and then put down into a bin very gently because you don't want them to be bruised. And then it'll be time, like in January, February, to start to prune. Now that means there, get that ladder and get your saw and get your pruners, and it all has to be pruned. If you stop and think of all the hand labor of just thinning your apples, picking your apples, now pruning your apples. There's a lot of labor in an apple tree. I can remember the year I was out there picking the apples with the pick-yourself people. And she says, oh, you're almost finished with your crop, huh? And I said, yeah, we'll be finished here in another week. Then would you go to Hawaii, or where do you go now? And I said, no, ma'am, we got to work the ground. We're going to be ready for pruning here soon. And, what? I said, well, yeah, we have to get it ready for next year. You mean it's not just finished? I said, no, there's other things to do on the farm. It's amazing, you know. It's good to get the people educated about what farming is all about.
Visitors these days who come to pick their own apples at Gizditch Ranch, it seems, only get a glimpse of what it means to truly do farm labor. On our way up to the Gizditch Farm strawberry patch.
Oh my gosh.
Look at that boy, that's a good size.
That is a whopper.
An animal the size of a small dog runs across our path.
That's a big jackrabbit.
What did we just see?
We saw a jackrabbit. Boy, that's a big healthy one running across there. Rabbits will eat the young tree when we plant the young trees, so we have to be very careful.
It's May and the height of the strawberry harvest. Nita Gizditch picks a fruit the size of a small apple. Its plump, shiny skin is an almost neon red.
Well, I want to tell you that it's about 2 inches tall, and there's nothing the matter with it. It is so perfect. After all this rain, I can't believe the size of the berry and what it looks like. It doesn't look like another fruit. It looks like I got 2 strawberries on top of each other. It's so big.
Looks like it had hormone therapy.
Almost.
Yeah, huge, gargantuan.
And I'm going to eat it right
no.
now.
That one's the way it's supposed to taste.
Nearby, 2 workers are bent over 2-foot-tall rows, picking off moldy strawberries.
Más duro por
La espalda.
Ya, por la espalda, ya, pues es de hueco y parado, es, no, es más, algo más normal.
Sí.
Aquí no, pues como anda uno agachado todo el día, 9 horas.
Most of the workers on Gizditch Farms have been here for more than a decade. After her husband Vince died last year, the job of checking immigration documents fell to Nita, who says her family came here the legal way, and so should her workers.
All our labor comes up out of Mexico.
Yeah.
And we appreciate everyone that comes. But I want you to be legal when you come, okay? I can't go to Mexico without my passport. I'd end up in jail. Now, why give it to the farmer? Years ago, we used to have the immigration would come out to the fields just like this on a picking day. And they would go out to the field and say, you got your card, you got your card, you know. And sometimes you'd see the workers take off running to the back part of the orchard because you know they were illegal.
These days, Gizditch Ranch keeps labor costs low by letting customers pick their own fruit. As we stroll past stacks of old apple crates, Nita wonders whether there will be a fourth generation of Croatian farmers here.
And not just only my grandchildren. You ask other farmers' kids, you're going to be a farmer like your father? No, I'm not going to work that hard. And that's what you hear.
You're listening to Pastures of Plenty, a history of California's farm workers. I'm Rachel Ann Goodman.
I'm Luis Valdez, your host for Pastures of Plenty, a history of California farm workers. We'll look at a story we think we know from reading The Grapes of Wrath, the story of the Depression and the Dust Bowl. But history is always more complicated than a good novel.
Here's a recipe. Take one land of milk and honey and add immigrants from Europe, Mexico, the Philippines, and Asia. Wait 30 years. Add Dust Bowl refugees and mix it all up in the crucible of the Great Depression. Then cut everybody's wages in half. What you get is one of the most tumultuous times in labor history. By 1935, 400,000 people were fleeing the drought in Oklahoma and other Midwestern states looking for work. Rural counties in California saw a 50% increase in population, mainly along the San Joaquin Valley. At first, says historian Sandy Lydon, the growers were jubilant.
For 75, 80 years, the farmers in California and the general population had said, God, if we can only get some white people to come work in the fields. That's the trouble with this system. We need white people. If we can get some grateful white people. And there had been experiments. Spaniards were brought in after the turn of the century. Portuguese were brought in into Hawaii and in small numbers here in California. You know, they're looking for anybody that, you know, maybe they'll understand better, maybe they won't organize or something. So, hey, now we have the Dust Bowl. And these people starting to come in, and they're white people. And it's almost like, you know, the agribusiness folks in California going, yes, thank you, Lord, we're finally going to get our white people. And then the reality came, and the reality was they were poor white people. And they brought their families. And they ultimately will have a pension to organize.
This is a song that was composed in the 1939 Arvin Cotton Strike. Three strikers composed this song, including myself. The title is Associated Farmers Have a Farm.
When the first migrants from Oklahoma began to arrive in the early 1920s, they found abundant work. Ed Maple's family came from Alabama and worked the crops up and down the San Joaquin Valley. Now 90, his memories of life as a migrant worker are still as vivid as if it were yesterday.
28, we moved to and still farmed cotton in east of Tipton, Woodville. 29, we moved to Porterville. They got a bigger farm. We farmed there. And that was there that year when the stock market crashed in 29.
How did the stock market crash affect your family?
Well, the only thing mattered, a few months later, we got pretty hungry. See, we, that time, I was in 29, and we left there and went to Imperial Valley. Back there, my dad went back to Imperial Valley. 31, we left Delano and went to, came to Hollister and picked apricots. That was in 31. My dad was getting out in the field picking them, I think 17 cents an hour.
It's a mighty hard road that my poor hand is hoed. My poor feet has traveled a hot, dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we rolled, and your desert was hot and your mountains was cold.
We started in Hollister late in May, early in June. Then we went there to Marysville. Then from Marysville to Woodland, then from Woodland to Sebastopol, then back to Delano. Probably about time for the grapes, cottons, to work. Well, the grapes, you can at least eat them.
I worked in your orchards of peaches and prunes, slept on the ground in the light of your moon. On the edge of your city, you'll see us, and then we come with the dust and we go with the wind. California and Arizona, I make all your crops, and it's north up to Oregon to gather your hops. Dig the beets from your ground, cut the grapes from your vine, to set on your table your light sparkling wine. Green pastures of plenty from dry desert ground, from that Grand Coulee Dam where the water runs down. Ever stayed in this union, us migrants have been. We'll work in this fight, and we'll fight till we win. Well, it's always we ramble, that river and I. All along your green valley, I'll work till I die. My land I'll defend with my life if it be, 'cause my pastures of plenty must always be free.
Historian Sandy Lydon.
The Okies came with a lot of baggage. They came with kids. And in some ways, they came as mirror images of the people that would employ them. There was the reality that everyone in America was close to being like them, you know, two paychecks away from living out of their car, like the Okies. And it was almost that they didn't like to see themselves in that.
This is Mary Kelman and Margaret Treat. We are from the Shaffa Government Camp. We are going to sing a song composed by Mary Kelman, Betty Kelman, and Margaret Treat. We call it the Government Camp Song. Over here in the government camp, that's where we get our government stamps, over in that little rag house home. Over in the isolation, that's where we get our vaccinations, over in that little penthouse home. Over in Unit 1, that's where the people have their fun, over in that little rag house home. Over in Unit 2, that's where the people go without their shoes, over in that little rag house home. Over in Unit 3,
people that came out to work there was starving and hard up. So my dad and this guy took food to these people, you know, gathered food up around. And this one worker, my dad really got mad. He said that this guy wouldn't let his kids have that food. Oh, you communists, you radicals. And my dad said, you all think of your kids. That's your idea. That's not theirs. But he wouldn't let the kids have the food. And they were starving.
That's where the people need a new creation, over by that little rag house home. Over at the library, there's where the people like to tarry, over by the little rag house home. Over at the sewing room, it needs a woman and a broom, over by the little rag house home. Over at the welfare, it sure gets in the people's hair, over by that little rag house home. Over at the reservoir, it needs cleaned by man and boy, built, and that's what I've nursed for the children over at that little raghouse home.
The Okies wrapped their cold dreams in army blankets and patchwork quilts and slept away the foggy winter nights of 1935. From doorways of tents and hasty shacks, now and then a boxcar, they watched for spring as they would watch for the second coming of Christ, and saw the valley change from skim milk blue, still needing sweaters, to palest green that filled their eyes with hope. As they waited for odd jobs, the valley burst forth with one imperial color. Poppies flung their gold over acres of sand, like all the bankers of California gone raving mad. Women wept in wonder and hunted fruit jars to can. First Spring in California, 1936, by Wilma Elizabeth McDonald.
The Dust Bowl migrants were right in there trying to compete with other Filipinos and Mexicans trying to get jobs. And of course, the growers would use tactics of putting out flyers saying they needed 150 workers when they maybe only needed 50 workers. And so people would, you know, get up early in the morning and go to the farms, and the person would say, gee, I only need 50. Who wants to work for a nickel today?
That's Wayne Maeda, a lecturer in ethnic studies at Sacramento State University.
They claim in Sacramento fields are ripe. Well, they said that about the kernel, and that wasn't right. So onward we go to the next picked-over rows, where dreams are dashed with the sun on our backs. Hey, hillbilly boy, where you gonna work today? Where you gonna get your pay? Where you gonna lay your head? Where you gonna get your bread, old hillbilly boy?
The plight of California's starving Dust Bowl refugees was spread around the world by people like Dorothea Lange and John Steinbeck, eventually resulting in relief programs. But Lange's desolate portrait of the migrant mother wasn't the whole picture, says historian Sandy Lydon.
The popular imagination and the popular culture has locked on to the image, I think. There was still a lot of anti-Japanese things going on. The Mexicans are being taken away. The Filipinos are being repatriated. That's not in the popular imagination.
Coming up right after this short break, more voices from the Dust Bowl and a look at the bloodiest battles in farm labor history. I'm Rachel Ann Goodman. Stay tuned.